Hello.
Hi, Jing. So Jing from Soil is here.
Hi.
And giving us her hour. And A, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I know you have to rush off to teach right after this, so we'll try to keep it compact.
And hopefully some of my students are listening.
Yeah. You can pick up some secrets about Jing. You can like lob back at her in the next class. But just to finish up, the party was fun. So Angela, who is our second guest of the whole show, like I said, she was the chef at Mission Chinese and stuff, and she basically selected four different Chinatown dishes, cheap dishes. And so we just filled the table up. So it was fun.
Cool.
Anything with like food and...
What are the four dishes? I'm curious.
She had the sesame pancake from Vanessa's Dumplings. It's funny because it was all I feel like everybody, so many people's first things they eat when they come to Chinatown or for the first time. So the sesame pancake from Vanessa's, the beef sort of spicy sandwich from Spicy Village. Mm-hmm. We got the peanut butter noodles from the place whose name I always forget, but I really like, which is next to Vanessa's. Mm-hmm. It's like a Fuzhou place. And then, fried chicken from Kanji Village.
Classy.
It was all very brown. I don't think we had any vegetables.
And the kind of fingers food. Right?
Yeah, totally. And when we first started, because we had no idea if people were going to come out, there were maybe like 20, 25 people here, and we had a mountain of food. And I was like, oh, fuck, we have way too much food.
But then
you turn around, and it was like an hour later, it was all gone.
Oh, okay.
A bunch more people showed up.
Yeah.
The food disappeared. But it was fun. So I'd like to start off just kind of talking about what you're up to now. I mean, not only just in Seoul, but like literally, what are you doing this week with your job? Like, what does your job entail this week? Whatever you can talk about, obviously.
This is actually a very relaxed week because last week I was in, well, where was I last week? I was traveling somewhere, and now I can't even, if I don't travel for 2 days, I forget what I was doing 2 days before at this point. But this week I'm here. I think last week I was in China, and then next week I'm going to Dubai. So this week is one of those rare weeks that I'm in New York the whole time. My jobs entail at this moment just catching up. The first half of the week was catching up, and then the next half of the week, we're already in the next half of the second half of the week, it's to be a little bit more projective.
Okay.
So now I'm just working on some projects that I haven't given too much attention to.
Sure.
And the lectures and workshops that I have to prepare. So those are really actually productive moment because you feel like you're accumulating something rather than just catching up on something. You're being more projective and productive. Yeah.
Reminding.
It feels really good.
It does?
Yeah, to work towards the future and not only, saying sorry to the past.
Just be like, what? That's so insightful sounding. But it's rare that you're here for a solid week.
Yes, it's very rare recently.
I assume this is because of work, always traveling for projects?
Yes. Projects and teaching.
Mostly. Okay. Yeah. And right now you're teaching at Pratt?
Yes, which is also a good thing that I'm teaching locally, which is not always the case.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. But I do have to next month go to Taiwan for a workshop.
Okay.
Which is very exciting because I'm Chinese, but I've never been to Taiwan. And it's always been one of my dream destinations. So I literally said yes to this teaching to go to Taiwan.
You're like, Taiwan sounds great.
Yeah, it sounds great. And then I'm going to have architects to take me around to see all the things that
That's
I
awesome.
Need to see in a few days. That seems like the best
is this
arrangement.
Through a university there?
Yes.
Can you talk about that workshop at all or not yet?
No, that's on my list to still think about what I'm going to do. Yeah.
So it's not an NDA. It's still like in progress.
Yeah.
And I know that your office is in downtown Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. How long have you had that space now?
3.5 years.
Okay. Yeah. Are you guys already overgrowing that space? It was a big space when you guys took it over.
Yes, it was a big space because our previous space could accommodate comfortably 10 people. Mm. By the time we left, we were 20 people. And so you can imagine how uncomfortable that was. At some point, I didn't want to go into the office anymore because there were just sheer mass of human body. It was
insufferable. I'm going to travel. I have trips to take.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to work from home because I need my conference room. So we were very much looking forward to, at that point to moving to a space where the space can comfortably accommodate probably 25, 30 people. Mm. But we haven't been really filling it completely. Okay. So we're about 20 people.
That sounds nice, actually.
That means we could make model. If right. we really try to stuff it with 30 people, we probably can't right. make as many model and as many mess as we.
So I know that the last project that sort of an, let's say, mass architecture media that I'm familiar with was the Davis Museum, mm-hmm. which is now what opened a year ago or a little less?
Oh, more.
More, actually. Oh, okay.
Yeah, probably 2 years now.
Oh, yeah. Crap. I guess I need to catch up on your work. can you talk about any of the work you're doing now that is not under, let's say, NDA?
Oh, yeah. I don't think we have projects under NDA so much. We are working on a bunch of very different scale projects. The biggest one being the Asia Olympic Village.
Oh, wow.
In 2022, that's going to take place in Hangzhou, which is not far from my hometown, which is Nanjing. It was high-speed trains, 1 hour commute at this moment. So, yeah, it's a maybe 200,000 square meters of plot with three cultural buildings and a bunch of commercial buildings and 100,000 square meters of landscape.
That's amazing. Are you designing everything from the master plan to the buildings to
yes.
the...
Yes. I mean, there is a overall master plan of the entire village. Our plot is the most important kind of cultural plot. Mm. So there is a planning guidelines, but everything within that guideline is all... Yeah, it needs to be designed, basically.
And is it fair to say this is your largest project to date?
Yes. Okay. By far, I think. Yeah.
Jing's eyes just got really wide when she yes, in case you're wondering how big this project is.
I think, you know, in the office even, it took the entire office about a month to figure out what scale we're talking about. You know, we were just doing this diagram and thinking we're designing one building, yeah. and you realize, wow, that building is like three city blocks.
Yeah. And because, I mean, the scale of the work that you guys have been doing, it seems like it's leapt exponentially over the last couple of years. Was that intentional? Like, were you like, we need to keep pushing towards bigger buildings or bigger projects?
Not necessarily. We do get asked quite a bit by people to participate in competitions that are much larger than our portfolio shows, which I guess is a good thing that they have, you know, seen something in our work that can translate, the idea can translate across different scales. we had many, many failures too. I would say, like, in the beginning, we ourselves were very conscious about not being able to handle the scale. And, you know, the design process needs a completely different muscle when you're dealing with a bigger project. And I think now, in the last maybe year or two, we have become a little bit more comfortable with a bigger scale project. In the beginning, it was more about just understanding what it means. Mm. You know, the different cycle of productions and understanding the relationship between human and then the urban and then, you know, the mega urban. I mean, like, there are a few steps in between, right?
Had you had, like with the Olympic Village project, had you had experience in your work experience in previous offices before you started SOL on scales like this?
Yes, but quite different. I mean, I worked at the KPF when I first started in New York, and a lot of the projects were at this scale, but it was very commercial, so there was a certain formula, right? Like office buildings and residential. So the formula is quite set. But with culture buildings at this scale, it's a little bit of a different story.
But how far are you in the process right now?
So the concept and the competition is won, and we're doing schematic at this moment.
Okay. Yeah. Can you talk about and this is mostly because I think the mechanics of how what running an office is like, certainly, but even certain projects like this. Can you talk about what is the design timeline for a project of this size?
Well,
like, how long will you be designing before construction starts?
Well, this is China, so...
Very short.
I wouldn't say that this is what typically happens in office, but we're working, you know, within the framework of the Chinese speed. But I think the construction we're estimating about 2 years.
Okay.
So backwards, we have to finish all the design by, you know, end of 2020.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So probably the DD is going to go until summer next year.
Mm. And so you were mentioning that before we started talking that you would just come back from. Wait, no, I forgot where you just said you come back from. You were going to Dubai in a minute, and you came back from where?
Yeah, I came back from China.
From China. So obviously, a lot of the work is international.
Mm-hmm.
Is that also intentional to kind of?
That is intentional, because. I mean, we just get very excited about different cultures and talking to different people and challenging and being challenged. And I think you know, it's like if you only type in computer, you only use web muscle,
right?
So I think we get a little bit bored of that and also feel that you can very easily repeat yourself and feel comfortable about, you know, what works and then just keep going with that. And to constantly put yourself on toe in a way, it's productive, I think, as a creative person.
In that regard, are you actively trying to do work that you haven't done before? Or in terms of, or maybe in other ways, actually not to do the work that you've already done before?
Yes and no, because every time, you know, even if you're doing another residential, because if the client's different and the challenges are different, you can always approach it in a different way. So there's not the one type of project that we would say that we've done enough of it, that we have exhausted all possible approaches, so not at this moment, at least.
Do you have any concerns, or do you run into issues where you're trying to explain that you can actually do a wide? Okay, you have an incredibly eclectic portfolio, even at this point, and it seems like it's getting wider. Is there the concern of or strategy in terms of explaining to clients or attracting clients or collaborators that are looking for a specific type of work that maybe you haven't done? And showing that actually this is totally within our capacity or at least our interest?
Well, I think historically we've had a hard time to convince developers that we could do a profitable residential building. I think currently the developer's world is either do something very fast and very standard so that there's nothing out of the line for the mass market, and or doing something super bespoke and very expensive to the higher market, right? And we are not in either one of them. I mean, like, we don't really do expensive projects, you know, or the project that looks expensive. And we don't have the brand name to just, like, put ta-da,
right?
You know, like, over
on the scaffold.
Yeah, on the scaffold and be able to charge more, right? And I don't think that's our ambition as an architect at all, anyways. So, yeah, definitely. I think we have a hard time to maybe convince developers that we want to do something experimental. But I do think that there is a room for that. For example, this week we just opened a show in the Design Museum in London called The Home Future. And I've been personally also interested in this topic of reinventing the domestic space. As you know, that there's a lot of politics and economics that happens in the domestic space that influence actually the larger social structure. And we haven't been able to talk about that enough in the profession. So, you know, even in teaching, and I've taught some studios about that. And this Home Future installation, or exhibition with the Design Museum, we've also participated quite a bit in the curatorial, you know, effort, and try to give enough substance to this conversation, both historically and contemporarily, so that there can be a critical discourse about how do we reinvent our domestic economy and the domestic space, and how do we go about in, you know, affordabilities and urban densities and those issues.
Are you often trying to pursue interests that you have outside of the projects on your plate? Like, let's say with an exhibition or through teaching, is that important, I think, to kind of continue?
Yeah, definitely. I think if it's just a client-driven project, sometimes you don't know going into that conversation what you can offer, mm-hmm. and then it's driven by something that's already right. pre-established. And I think if it's, there's a moment that you can, without the pressure of the outside or the client, to think about what you can offer to this conversation, then even in the dialogue with the client later, it's mutually more satisfying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So neither you nor Florian are originally from the U.S., right?
No. Yeah.
So I guess the question is basically, why did you set up in New York? But it's kind of framed, in, especially when you were talking about, let's say, not depending especially on developer work, the kind of notion of the kind of classic work you see offices do, and I'm asking this from a very personal point of view also from our office, is developer work or commercial or retail work or single family home, especially in the U.S. But you guys have been able to not only set up your office in New York, but actually kind of sidestep or skip over that to start working internationally. Was it intentional that you saw there was a limit in the kind of market that New York was affording, or just, again, you needed to kind of expand more and work in other places?
Well, I think it's twofold. I mean, because we're foreigners, we didn't really know those markets, mm-hmm. and we didn't know people who had money to do, you know, single home families, homes. Single family homes were people who had shops, you mm-hmm. know. Like, we didn't know the New Yorkers
right.
that would commission those projects. We didn't know the developers. So our platform of participating or getting new work is often through connections outside of New York, mm-hmm. from previous connections or participating in international competitions. And I think, you know, just maybe the, you know, just necessity of looking elsewhere. Mm. We didn't go for the, you know, the typical market, New York market.
Why did you decide to set up in New York in the first place? Or did you set up in New York in the first place?
No, we set up the office, and we were already physically in New York.
Okay.
but there was not a really critical discussion of why it had to be in New York. Mm. Again, you know, we didn't have any client in New York from the beginning, so it could have been anywhere. But I think even to this day, between Florian and I, we cannot convince each other of moving to anywhere else. Mm. I think just by default of not being able to do that,
we
might as
well
stay. Yeah.
Have you had any satellite or offices, small offices elsewhere out of New York?
No, we always talked about it, and then there was always ambition of doing it. The logistics is very difficult. Mm. We don't want to just have office that doesn't do design
right.
and just administer a project from, you know, like a satellite office like that. So if we do a satellite office, it would not be satellite, it would be just another office, mm-hmm. and there should be a design culture there as well, and that takes a long time to build, and you have to constantly garden, mm-hmm. you know, that, and we just currently don't have the capacity nor the portfolio to do that. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. And can we quickly talk about, you mentioned you look to competitions quite a bit to kind of expand. Because I know a lot of, especially, again, myself and people that are starting offices are always questioning what the role of a competition is, whether it's worth the time, whether it's worth the resources, what the return actually is on the competition. Do you pursue competitions that are invited only, or do you actually pursue also open to everyone type competitions?
We, in the beginning, we pursued a lot of open competitions, and now just by you know, financial pressures, we mm. typically only have the resources to do the one that we are shortlisted mm. and invited. I think recently we've done an idea competition, which was very free and nice, that we didn't have to worry about building
right.
it. And so that was, again, like a refreshing experience that we haven't had for a while. Now it's all invited and shortlisted.
Do you know roughly at any given time how many competitions you have going on in the office? Do you always have a thread of competitions happening?
No, not always, but I think within a year, typically 2-3 competitions
cool.
at least. Yeah.
So I was going to ask kind of when you guys first started, how long have you been so ill now?
10.
Okay. Mm-hmm. When you first started, what was your very first project, or how did you start the office?
We started the office based on 3 paying clients, and it seemed like it made the sense if someone's going to pay us, we should set up office. And one of them was a feasibility study for a private museum,
okay,
which didn't end up going beyond the feasibility and concept of design, but the guy was, you know, generous enough to actually pay quite well for the work we did. And the other one is Derek Lam's office. Mm. That was actually our first completed project in New York, actually internationally. And that project, yeah, that was the one that, I don't think it's there anymore, Derek Lam's.
Yeah, I heard they moved.
Yeah, it was on Crosby Street above mm-hmm. Sana's store. Mm-hmm. And
were those happening in parallel, Sana's store in your office?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was, I think there was another project for a private home, which okay. also didn't go forward. The financial crisis hit and the money... Right. left.
So this project. Was right, you started the office basically right at the beginning of the financial crisis, mm-hmm. or maybe a year before, something like that?
I think Lehman Brothers literally went bankrupt 2 weeks after we started our office. Was that great timing? Yeah.
With the, of those three projects.
Only one survived.
So one survived, but one, but all three had paid anyway.
Yeah, also paid to okay. a certain point.
And had you and Florian, before deciding to form Soil, had you guys worked together at all?
Briefly, very briefly.
Okay.
And I was interning at Sana, and when he was working at Sana. So we had maybe 3-4 months overlap.
But you had enough of a sense to know that you could work together?
No.
No.
We're still trying to figure out if we can work together.
Of the three projects that came in at the beginning, were they necessary that you guys had to do them together?
It was the private.
I don't mean to split up your office. I guess I'm just I was curious, like with the formation of, you know, why you decided to partner, why you decided to run an office that way.
Yeah,
is always very curious.
We set up an office actually before even those three projects mm. came. It was more of a romantic idea. We're going to do an office
right.
together. You know, there was nothing really. You know, we just got drunk and came
yeah,
up
nice.
With a name, and there was no project at that moment. And then, you know, I think the conception of a project. I mean, office. Existed, and then you start to kind of really start to talk to people like, oh yeah, we have an office,
yeah.
you can hire us now, actually. And then those three projects came, and then I think the real starting of the office was physically renting a desk,
right.
and that seemed like a commitment.
Yeah.
And before that, it was just a name, you know, and registration number, and it's nothing, you know, very substantial. And I did that Derek Lam project because I had more New York construction experience.
Okay.
And that seemed like a necessary thing, although I had a job at that time.
Were you still at KPF?
No, I was working for Starwood at that moment,
oh, okay.
doing project management and design management. Mm. And so I had a lot of New York construction experience, and that seemed necessary for that project. Mm. And the other two projects was mainly run by Florian.
Oh, okay. Were you? Was it just the two of you when those three projects were going?
No, we had staff from the beginning. We had staff from the beginning, and we were very, very adamant about. We never paid ourselves in the first 8 years, so we're 5 years in the office.
Amazing.
So we always paid ourselves from teaching, and so we didn't take a salary from the office. But we were always adamant that the office would pay for itself.
Mm-hmm.
We would not load our lifestyle to the office because we know how hard you know how hard it is to run a creative office in New York. But we were persistent that you know, if we believe in the value of the work we do. It should at least pay for itself.
Mm.
If we say that, you know, we're going to do things pro bono, then you're also devaluing
right.
the value of the work you do. Right?
And that model of teaching to pay yourselves and then having, I guess, the fees from the projects pay the staff
mm-hmm.
or pay for the office in general, it seems like a model that on paper makes a lot of sense, but I can't imagine, I'm sure there is a moment where you had to sort of decide to focus on one or the other, or no? Were you able to kind of keep them going in parallel? I mean, I guess you're still teaching.
We always did. Mm. We also had it kept both going. But I think on paper, yes, it works. Physically, it's very hard.
And do both of you teach?
Yes. And for a long time, Florian was traveling back and forth between Boston and New York quite frequently, and that's a lot of work. Yeah.
And have you ever taken a significant break away from teaching since you started the office? You're like, oh, we need a year off or 2 years off?
No. We never could afford it. But we did scale back a little bit.
Okay.
It's too much. Yeah. And we did, in the last few years, feel like it's important to focus on the office a little bit more. And but teaching has always been not only financially necessary, but also just mentally necessary to keep, especially as we got older, it's important to be connected with young people. You know, I learn as much from them as they learn from me. And, you know, the fight and the argument between the students is always productive.
Can you talk about it for the Derek Lamb project? Mm-hmm. How did that relationship come about? How did you meet them in the first place?
From Sana.
Oh, okay.
Because they were doing the store downstairs and they didn't want to do the office upstairs. Yeah. So we said, we'll like, do it. Yeah, how about us?
Yeah. That's awesome.
It's very simple.
And when you were at Sana, this was out of Tokyo?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go from KPF to Sana and then back to...
No, Sana to KPF. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. KPF was a long-term project. Yeah.
How long were you there?
I was there for 4 years, I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Did you always know that you wanted to start an office?
Yes. Yes. I wasn't sure if I was going to be an architect, but I was sure that I was going
to start something.
Something by myself. Yeah.
What did you think you might be instead? Or what did you want to be before you became an architect?
I started also writing a little bit more these days. I always wanted to write something.
Do you still get to write now?
Yeah, I think I'm starting to, if I have the time, to contribute here and there a little bit more through words. But I do believe in the space on the paper to... be able to communicate something that's different. It does grab you in a different way. There's a more time span that you can engage someone on in the space of the paper, and you can make your point in a much more framed way. I mean, architecture is the opposite, right? Like, you walk by a storefront, this person might engage it and might not engage it, and even when they come in, you have no idea what they're looking at, you know, if they're on their phone or maybe they're noticing the toilet,
right.
You know, you want them to look at the light, right? So it's a much more open-ended way of engaging your audience in a way. But I think there's something nice about also the framed, controlled space of the paper.
Whether it's writing or, let's say, other pursuits that are not an immediate requirement of a project, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about carving out time for those kind of things? Or do you not?
Well, I don't, yeah. Typically, it's after the kids go to bed. And I think, okay, it's not 11 o'clock yet. Maybe I can sneak in.
Plenty of time.
Yeah.
Where were you before? So you went Starwood, backwards, KBF, Sana. Where were you before Sana?
I was just at school.
For architecture?
Yeah.
Where at?
At the New Orleans, at Tulane.
So at that point, were you like, I'm going to be an architect, or are you just at school for architecture?
Yeah, I was just in school for architecture. I wasn't sure if that was what I wanted to do. I mean, I knew that I was interested in it enough to do it for a while, but I wasn't sure how long I was going to do it.
Do you still feel that way? Or you're like, it's still pretty good, I like it a lot, and we'll see if something changes? Or are you pretty fully committed now?
I think we have been lucky enough to have projects that have been interesting and also keep offering enough room for experimentation and enough room to learn. I don't think I would have done architecture if it's not, if I didn't have that opportunity to do that. Because the architecture can also be very repetitive. I guess that's a personality issue.
Did you have any did you know any architects when you were growing up? Like, did you see that as a profession? Be like, oh, that's something I could do, or it's like a thing that people do to make money.
No, I didn't think either. You know, I'm from China. I grew up in a time where architecture is not yet has not taken off yet. So no one talked about architecture. We all lived in the vernacular houses. Mm. You know, there's nothing special about them. No one gave it too much thought, right? So it was not something that I grew up with. I came from a family more of a writer and a painter, so like an engineer. So it was not, architecture was not a part of our family history as well. I started to learn a little bit more about architecture when I moved to Japan, and you realize, okay, there are all these different styles and there were different periods. I didn't know the metabolism and at that moment, but it's present enough to know that, okay, someone gave it some mm-hmm. thought and there was some, you know, intentionality there. And then when I was going to school, I think, you know, journalism and literature was not in the bags for me because my English was so bad. No one would accept me into a language-driven major at that moment. So I thought that, well, you know, I'm interested in architecture and I, you know, in physics and math. Physics and math were something that I was more interested in. I like abstract things. And I also like, you know, art was something that was always read in my family. So I thought, okay, this seems like a nice thing to study that combines all my interests. And as a profession, I never thought about it as a profession. It's more of a passion and pursuit.
You lived in Japan before Tulane? Mm-hmm. For how long?
6 years.
Was that with your family?
Yeah.
Where in China did you move from when you went to Japan?
You're really investigating.
We're in high school now. We're almost in high school now. This is where it gets fun. The high school stuff is fun. More of the good stories come in like the high school years.
No, actually, now I'm working with a Japanese client, and I haven't spoken Japanese in that way for years and years, and it's kind of fun. Because in a casual conversation, they can't tell that I'm not Japanese. My Japanese is good enough to pass as a Japanese. But then when I start to really talk about like conceptual stuff and architecture stuff, like words don't come out, and then it feels very weird.
I mean, that's still pretty impressive that you've retained it long.
Yeah, so one of the reasons that I'm quite excited about doing this project is
to be able to like pick that up again.
Yeah, it up again and to see what's going on in Japan again. Yeah.
Mm. I mean, a big theme that gets covered in the radio show so far is naturally a lot of people that are here are American, but they're minority of some sort. And so that kind of question of whether they feel American or not, especially now with current politics. Yeah. But you're not American, obviously.
I was never Japanese. That's why I left.
I was going to say, do you feel that America is home or that New York is home at the moment? Or has it ever felt that way?
In good moments, yes. I feel when the weather is nice and, you know, the election goes well.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like, hey, I can live here. And actually, every time I travel abroad and I come back to New York, I do, like, let out a sigh. Mm. Like, okay, finally, you know, like, I'm in a comfortable place. Right. I don't have to haggle. I don't have to feel the, you know, pollution or the cars and, you know, the weather, whatever it is, or the people, right, that I have to fight with. So New York does has become some place, you know, for me as a comfort. Mm-hmm. But that's more physical and friends, sure. You know, just familiarity a little bit. I'm not sure if I feel I'm American yet. Mm. And I don't even know what that means, actually.
Has that affected being, I guess, especially when you first, let's say, got to Tulane and you weren't speaking English that well, I can imagine you felt very foreign.
Foreign, yeah.
At that point, I guess part of it is I think that to start something on your own, there's obviously a bit of confidence that people have to have, even if it's a very questionable confidence, even like, I don't know if it's going to work, but you have to be willing to kind of put yourself as an individual out there, which I think whether you're American or not, whether you're a minority or not, But especially, I think, with people that don't feel quite like they belong, it's a hard thing to step up in front of the mic, let's say, in this case.
Yeah.
At that point when you got to Tulane, do you remember that you always, were you still, I need to start something on my own at some point, whatever that might be?
Yeah, I think, I think my confidence at that moment, especially when I was young, in my teenage years and 20s, came out of just moving around. I remember I had a really difficult time going to Japan, and I didn't speak a single word of Japanese when I moved there either. So I have this experience of just being thrown into a situation and struggle and somehow like swim, you know, after a while. And I think once you had that experience, the confidence really came out, you know, really come out, and just I don't know how I'm going to make it work, but eventually, you know, if I'm giving enough time and enough space, that one way or the other, I'm going to make it work. So I think that's how I felt maybe when we started the office. There was a little bit of that ignorance.
Right. Or that lack of fear, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah.
Are there any other people in your family that are entrepreneurial?
Yeah, my father's family are all entrepreneurial.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We are all there. My father's family are spread around the entire world. A branch is in Australia, a branch is in Japan, and there was a branch that was in New York, and they went back. So there was a lot of moving around.
When you say branch, you mean of the family or of the
branch
company?
Family. Yeah.
Not the business or whatever.
No.
So were you always? Because I think it's nice to hear that people in your family were creative in some way, whether it's the arts or writing, and that on your father's side there is an entrepreneurial show. So that's sort of the generalization, but the kind of progression makes a lot of sense that you're starting something on your own, you're doing starting something creative on your own.
But I think I'm the one that went the furthest, also by myself. I remember, so my grandfather, who passed away at 99, during his 90th birthday, told me that you might think that moving to America by yourself is a very long journey and feel good about yourself, but but you know, 50 years ago or like 60 years ago, when I moved from the north of China to the south of China, that was a bigger journey to take. He was like really trying to be competitive with
You're like
me.
Thanks. I mean, do you feel it's in your blood to kind of push those journeys, kind of consistently, like stretch beyond what even your family
a little bit. I mean, like I moved to Japan first, and then moved to the UK, and then moved to New Orleans, and you know, so it's further away.
How do you position in your mind, I guess, your office right now, especially with, because you mean you guys are certainly very nimble, I think, with doing a lot of work in different places. But also there's a certain level of stability and foundation, obviously, that you have to kind of produce within the physical office itself and within New York City. Has that been a challenge to kind of stretch between a solidity and a kind of fluidity between able to move and stretch in places you haven't been before?
Yeah, we've been trying to work on the solidity part for a long time. It's difficult, yeah. We're doing more projects in New York now, both for public realm and also for private clients. And that's been very, very nice because, first of all, your site visit is much less work.
Right.
And, you know, there's some comfort in just understanding the process and what to predict. You know, DOB, as difficult as it is, you know, it's easier than dealing with a government of another country.
Sure.
Once you know what they're asking for. Yeah.
And then since you do spend a lot of time teaching, you're obviously seeing a lot of students, and I can imagine a lot of students of different ethnicities coming through. Another thing that I think that came up in a lot of interviews is the, and this is specifically, I think, especially for Asian kids, is the split at some point between going a route that's kind of more anonymous but stable, like not being that nail that sticks up, and at some point choosing something that you don't know if it's going to work, but actually being very unique about it and needing to do something different, and usually on your own. Are you seeing it all in the kind of years that you've been teaching a change in, let's say, the confidence to do that or the kind of mentality of the students that you teach to try to do something on their own?
It's always 50-50, though, almost. I think some students are in the U.S. Are you talking about the, like, immigrant students?
Yeah, I guess
students?
Immigrant or at least just minority, yeah, primarily.
Yeah, I think a lot of students now do feel like, especially given, you know, what's happening in America, do feel like this is just a very temporary experience.
To be in the U.S.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then they will get something out of it for a few years and then go back. And also because I think globalization is an irreversible effect, right? Mm-hmm. So even going back to your country, it's not like going back. You're still connected with this global network. Mm-hmm. So I think I see more and more people choosing to go back.
And do you get a
wherever they come from, yeah.
Sorry, good.
Yeah, not so many people are trying to start something here.
Like in the U.S.
Mm. I think it's also because the creative market here is so saturated, and a lot of people see that and think it's going to be very difficult, which is true. Yeah.
But a lot of them are going back to try to start something different or new on their own.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always curious, like, how many of them actually, like, succeed or push through it. But
I see a lot of students actually succeeding.
Oh, that's cool.
In their own ways, yeah. Hmm.
In terms of the saturated market thing, the other concern I had was also just, we keep talking about New York. I always get this sense that actually New York is not the best place to be a creative person because there's a lot of commercial pressures, and actually there's just, like, there's a lot of stimulus, which is great, but there's also a lot of distraction. And I guess we sort of talked about a little bit in terms of how to position the office. Are you, because you guys are very centrally located in New York and actually in a very busy area, do you find that generally advantageous for, not so much the business point, but actually being able to think about the kind of work you want to do, the kind of work you haven't done yet? Like, do you find that good as a creative person?
Yes, I think the stimulus is definitely good. You know, I think we don't want to be, we go to many different places, and I can already imagine being, kind of repeating myself if I stay in that place for too long. there's just not enough diversity of conversations to engage. And I think in New York, you never have that problem, which is great. But indeed, the financial pressure is very steep. But on the other hand, you also get a much more interesting people to work for you. I think the people who come to New York, the human resources that we're able to get, it's always, I mean, the staff, the quality of the staff is really high, precisely because a lot of people want to be here when they're young to be exposed to that conversation. And then they're all entrepreneurs themselves, so there's this drive, you know, they're not the people who seek for comfort. And I think that if you can find a team of a similar mentality, then the work is going to come out of it, you know, naturally.
It does seem like, I can't imagine many places that have more of a diversity of, I mean, literally not even just literal diversity of ethnicities, but diversity of types of people and types of designers, even and types of architects. It's Ryan's birthday today, so we're... Happy birthday, Ryan. So we got him pizza.
Yeah.
not only being...
It's also one of my students.
Jessica, really? Do you want to ask any questions? So she's been with us for a few years. It's been really nice to work with her. Even beyond, I think, being Asian, there's also just still not that many women leading architecture offices. Or I guess the question was, like, are you seeing a change there as well?
In New York, there are many Asian women leading architecture offices, but globally, no. And I always feel like I have to perceptually overcome three hurdles. One is that I'm Asian, you know, in the kind of the market of architecture, profession of architecture. The other one is I'm a woman. The other one is I look very young. It's like the three things that you should not be if you want to be convincing as an architect, right? I'm very aware of that, you know, whenever I go into a meeting and how hard I have to work against that perception.
What kind of things do you do to actively work against those?
I mean, you know, I think if people know you long enough, you know, maybe the first meeting they're a little bit skeptical, but if you know what you're talking about, after a few meetings, and then like, okay, you know, I think it's just not being too much influenced by this first impressions.
Even after being more established and actually a lot of amazing projects under your belt, do you still get a lot of biases for one of those three, if not all three of those perceptions, when new clients or collaborators meet you?
Less and less, for sure.
That's good.
And also, like, people know what to expect. You know, by now they know that, okay, they're going to work with an Asian woman. You know, hopefully by the time they come to us, they've done their research and they're not surprised that it's not someone else.
They didn't call you totally blind yet. I mean, the hope is, I think that it's nice, I think, especially with models like you, for example, that other Asians, other Asian women, just other people in general, can see that it's completely doable. Mm-hmm. Not only, I think, specifically through architecture, but pursuing a creative field and actually finding a way to make money from it totally blindly. So one of the kind of last questions that I've been asking everybody is, do you remember where you made your first dollar as a, not working for someone else, basically? It can be either SOL or actually even when you were a kid.
No, I don't remember. I'm not very, like, money has never been such a kind of impressionable thing to me. I think, you know, I guess we made enough money to not have to worry about it too much.
That's good.
Yeah. No, I never had that moment like, okay, finally I made my first dollar. No. I've always had a job when I was young, but not because of money, just because of experience. Mm. And yeah.
When you guys started, so I guess you had three projects. Did you ever have a moment where you weren't sure whether SOL was going to work?
No.
It was just like, we're doing it.
We're doing it. It might, sometimes we might not have money in the bank, but, you know, we'll figure it out.
Cool. I think that's also very helpful to hear. I think a lot of people, when they go through doubts, just to keep pushing for it.
I mean, you know, our first dip in the numbers in the career, in the last 10 years, I think, I don't remember who it is, it might be Stephen Ho, who said that, you know, I've had this, being in this profession for long enough that I know that every 7 years at least,
really?
You're going to have a dip, no matter how successful you are. So we're like, okay, I guess we just have to get used to it.
Cool. Well, you're welcome to stay for pizza if you like. I know you have to run off pretty soon, but thanks again for
the
hour.
Thank you for inviting me. It's fun.
Have fun at the class. And I'll see you. I see you in a few weeks at your review.
Yes. Yeah. You're coming. Don't bail out this time.
I already bailed once, so I can't do it twice. Thanks, Jing.
All right. Great.
See ya.
Bye.